KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Even in the grimmest times, I have seen glimmers of humanity, which reassured me that man's goodness is a flame that can never be extinguished.
So you take something like the tanker program, not only would it be under a continuing resolution at about half the level of funding that they had expected for this year, but that lower level of funding would then be cut by 10%.
Simply having a child that changes your life, then having a child who suddenly is diagnosed with a rare illness, is another form of jumping off a cliff.
We're going to talk about that cliff with Suzanne Edison, a poet and psychotherapist, about having a child with a rare illness. You also heard from Todd Harrison. We'll hear from him again in a moment on the defense budget and what it means for people involved in defense spending. And you heard at the top Nelson Mandela speaking about man's essential goodness. We're going to talk about a post-apartheid South Africa, a post-Mandela South Africa, and what that means today. By the way, an update, 716 guns were collected at the gun buyback program, according to Mayor Mike McGinn. Let's delve into defense spending now. The House voted last week to extend the government's borrowing authority, so that put off a showdown over the nation's debt limit until May. But the budget mess in Washington, D.C. has the military nervously watching. The Department of Defense is currently operating on a continuing resolution, with Congress not yet having passed a 2013 defense appropriations bill. Add to that the still-to-come fights over the debt ceiling and sequestration, and you're left with what Defense Chief Leon Panetta earlier this month called a perfect storm of budget uncertainty. Here's what Paul Ryan, Representative Paul Ryan, had to say on the Sunday talk shows about sequestration and defense cuts with David Gregory on NBC's Meet the Press.
We passed legislation. I wrote it and passed it in the House twice to replace those sequesters with cuts in other areas of government. So we've shown precisely how we should protect defense spending by cutting spending in other areas. And by the way, in our budget last year, we did take money out of defense, just not nearly as much as the president seems to want to. We think these sequesters will happen because the Democrats have opposed our efforts to replace those cuts with others, and they've offered no alternatives.
That's Paul Ryan on Meet the Press talking about sequestration and defense cuts. The impact of possible cuts to defense is being held here in Puget Sound, of course, where military employment is a major part of the economy. A civilian hiring freeze meant the cancellation of a job fair at Puget Sound Naval Shipyard. Newly elected Representative Derek Kilmer, whose 6th district includes the Bremerton Navy Yard, called the situation a prime example of what's wrong with Congress. Todd Harrison is Senior Fellow, Defense Budget Studies at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments in Washington, D.C. The Department of Defense's continuing resolution is funded at 2012 levels, and that keeps spending from shifting to change priorities.
What's in the continuing resolution is basically all accounts within the defense budget at the same levels they were in 2012, with a slight increase, a 0.6% increase from the 2012 level. So what that means is that the total defense budget is actually about $8 billion higher than had been requested by the administration for 2013, but the money is in the wrong accounts. It's stuck in the accounts at the same levels that it was last year. And, you know, within DOD, especially within acquisition programs, the level of funding changes significantly from year to year. So some accounts in 2013 under the continuing resolution have more money than they need, than they can use. Other accounts have less money than they need.
Which ones have more? Which ones have less?
Well, so a good example in the Seattle area is the Boeing aerial refueling tanker, the KC-46A. That program in 2012 had about $900 million in funding. In 2013, it was going to ramp up and nearly double its budget to $1.8 billion. But instead of having the $1.8 billion they were planning on for 2013, they are stuck at that $900 million level from 2012. So what that means is that the Air Force can't execute the program like they had planned to unless Congress comes back within the next few months and moves the money back to where it was supposed to be for 2013.
What does that uncertainty mean for a program like that? I mean, what's the on-the-ground uncertainty impact?
Well, what it means is that on the government side, the Air Force Program Office, they're going to have to start delaying decisions. And they may reach a point where they can't delay anymore, and they simply cannot fulfill the terms of the contract. They can't buy at the rate that they had planned to under the contract they had negotiated. So it may mean that they ultimately have to go back to Boeing and renegotiate that contract. And, you know, this is a good example where it's likely to end up costing the taxpayer more if they have to go back and renegotiate that contract, because, you know, by press reports, Boeing bid for the tanker contract at a loss. So the Air Force was getting quite a good deal on this contract. If they have to go back and renegotiate with Boeing, do you really think that the Air Force is going to walk out of that still getting such a good deal? Or are they actually going to have to pay more? I suspect that the Air Force will end up having to pay more because of this delay in funding.
We're looking at the Defense Department budget and it's the impact that sequestration and continuing resolution is having on it. Todd Harrison is a senior fellow, Defense Budget Studies at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessment in Washington, D.C. Well, if that's what's in the continuing resolution, what is the Pentagon looking for in 2013 that's not a part of the continuing resolution, its budget?
Well, they're looking to ramp up a number of programs like the KC-46A. They're looking to end a number of programs. And overall, they're looking to basically shift the focus within the Department of Defense to focus less on the types of capabilities and force structure that we've needed over the past decade of wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and focus more on the Asia-Pacific region. That is the new strategic focus for the U.S., and it requires very different capabilities, longer-range aircraft, stealthier platforms, you know, stealthy aircraft, submarines, different types of capabilities that are more suited to operations in the Pacific theater and going up against more sophisticated adversaries such as China. So, you know, that's what the Department of Defense was expecting to be able to do in its 2013 budget, begin that pivot to focus more on the Asia-Pacific region. And that really is on hold now that we're stuck under this continuing resolution.
What would the impact be of sequestration? When we talk about sequestration, what's its direct impact, if it occurs, on the defense budget?
So sequestration basically goes in and cuts 10% across the board, across every account, all the way down at the program project activity level. So you take something like the tanker program, not only would it be under a continuing resolution at about half the level of funding that they had expected for this year, but that lower level of funding would then be cut by 10%. And because the law mandates that it's an across-the-board cut, every program project activity would be affected across the department. So you're looking at things like having to furlough DOD civilian employees. You know, it would be cutbacks in contractors, service support contractors, cutbacks on nearly every acquisition program, every research and development effort, and cutbacks in readiness and training activities for the military. The only thing that would not be affected by sequestration is pay and benefits for the active duty military and the Guard and Reserve. So uniform military personnel would not see their pay cut as a result of this, but literally everything else in the defense budget would be cut by 10%.
You know, critics of federal government on the right as well as the left always talk about the bloat and the waste, fraud, and abuse in federal government. 10% cuts across the board, what would be wrong with that? Wouldn't the Pentagon just figure out a way to reset and be more efficient?
So the problem with doing it this way is that it's cutting the good with the bad. So you can imagine that if you had to institute a 10% cut across the defense budget, if you had the ability to target those cuts, there are some things you would probably cut more than 10% and some things that you would protect and maybe not cut them at all. You know, we spend over $300 million a year on military bands. It seems like if you have to make a sudden cut in the budget, that's probably an area you could do it without risking our national security. But there are other things where cutting 10% may actually end up costing you more in the long run because you have to renegotiate contracts. You'll be purchasing at a lower production rate. The unit cost will go up for a number of different types of weapon systems. So if you could target the cuts and you could do it in a thoughtful, rational, strategic manner, then it wouldn't be as bad. The other thing, too, is that these cuts happen rather abruptly. We're going to be more than halfway through well, almost halfway through, we'll be 5 months into the fiscal year by the time these cuts occur, you have to make up that 10% cut on an annual basis and only the 7 remaining months of the year. So that in itself is going to require more extreme action. So, you know, if you could target the cuts, it would be more manageable. And if it wasn't so abrupt, if you had a year or two to phase in the cuts, it would be more manageable. But that's not the way the law is written. The law is written that the cuts are abrupt and they're across the board.
You know, the Obama administration has cut about $889 billion from the defense budget since it took office. What is their projection for a defense budget over the next, well, the next biennium and out into the future?
Yeah, well, so when you talk about projections of cuts, first of all, they're on a 10-year basis. So it's not, you know, it's not something that has happened yet.
So that $400 billion, that $889 billion, that's a 10-year cut on defense starting in 2006 or 2008?
The numbers that I've seen actually start from 2012, because the defense budget grew under the first 2 years of the Obama administration. It was only in 2011 that we started to see a slight decline. But the cuts that you see over that 10-year window, that's relative to a baseline, right? The baseline that they're comparing to was DOD was expecting about 2% growth in its budget every single year. The baseline we have now, what the Obama administration proposed in their last budget request, was basically a flat defense budget. It would only grow with inflation for the rest of the decade. So the difference between growing at 2% a year over a decade and just staying flat over a decade actually comes out to a little less than $1 trillion. So that's the cut. It's a cut in growth in defense. Now, some people would say, oh, well, that's not so bad if you just have a flat budget. It's even growing with inflation. The problem for defense, though, is costs within the defense budget are growing faster than inflation. If you look at our military personnel costs, this is pay and benefits for a uniformed military, they grew at a rate of 4.2% a year above inflation over the past decade. So, you know, those internal costs are growing within the defense budget. If you're just going to hold the budget flat, you really have to get smaller over time because of internal cost growth.
Well, isn't the Pentagon already planning a major drawdown of forces, 70,000 soldiers over the next 7 years?
Yeah, they're planning to bring down in strength from its high of about 1.5 million in the active duty military to about 1.4 million in the active duty military. We'll still be larger than we were on September 11th, but you know it is going to be a slight gradual reduction in the military in strength. It's focused, the drawdown is focused on the Army and Marine Corps. Those two services grew substantially over the past decade to support deployments to Iraq and Afghanistan, so now they're basically rolling back that growth.
Now, there are supporters of expanded defense spending over this next decade. What are they talking about in terms of over the baseline growth, and where would they direct it?
So, you know, if you go back in the presidential campaign, the Romney team, they had focused on this idea of 4% for freedom, spend 4% of our GDP on defense going out into the future. And we actually are spending a little more than that on defense right now, if you include war funding. But they were actually just talking about the base defense budget, not including war funding. You know, under the Obama plan that holds defense spending basically flat with inflation for the rest of the decade, defense spending would drop below 3% in about 10 years, 3% of GDP. So spending 4% of GDP would be substantially more, it'd be about a third more we'd be spending on defense in the future. And over the next decade, that would add about $2 trillion to what we're spending on defense. So that'd be a significant increase. I don't think it's likely that that's going to happen, regardless of who is in power in the White House or in Congress, simply because of our federal deficits. You know, we're still running, you know, $1 trillion deficits every year. So adding additional defense spending above where we are just doesn't seem very likely at this point.
Todd Harrison studies the defense budget for the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. Now, some of the critics of what Defense Secretary Panetta and Robert Gates have overseen, they say, well, the smallest ground forces since 1940, a fleet of fewer than 230 naval ships, the smallest since 1915, smallest tactical fighter force in the history of the Air Force. Are they right? Is that an accurate assessment? And if they are, what does that mean?
Well, you know, some of those numbers are accurate. You know, our Navy, though, if you just look at ship count, first of all, the ship count's been growing under the Obama administration. But ship count alone really doesn't do it. In counting any number of these platforms, whether they're tactical fighters or a number of troops in the active duty Army, it's really not a valid comparison over such long periods of time. You know, for example, if you go back in the, you know, in the 19-teens and the 1920s, what kind of ships did we have at that time? You know, we had battleships. We didn't have anything like the modern nuclear-powered aircraft carriers, nuclear-powered submarines that we have today. So I don't think that's necessarily a good metric. When it comes to tactical fighters, you know, the whole premise of upgrading our fighter force to, you know, fifth generation fighters has been that, you know, if they're stealthy, all aspects stealth, supersonic, you know, can carry much more sophisticated weaponry, have much more sophisticated sensors, one plane can do the job of many planes from the previous generation. So the whole idea of spending more on things like the F-22 and the F-35 is that it doesn't have to be a one-to-one replacement.
You know, when you look at the politics behind the defense budget for a minute, I know that's not definitely your expertise, but just the many congressional representatives have defense industries in their districts, and there's a reason for that. And part of that is it makes it harder to cut because all those people, even the liberal Democrats, say this is about jobs. And,
right.
You know, you can look at the Joint Base Lewis-McChord, which could lose maybe 8,000 soldiers in the decade if these cuts go in. There's the Puget Sound Naval Shipyard, which is already cutting back on the recruiting program because there's uncertainty about what they're going to be doing going forward. Given that everybody has a dog in this hunt, what do you expect to come from a budget-cutting effort by the Defense Department? Will it be fair and clear and for the best projects, or will there be politics, of course, involved?
Well, you know, the fact that so many different members of Congress have something at stake in their district with the defense budget is precisely the reason that sequestration was put in place, and half of sequestration cuts are directed at the defense budget. That's why, is because it was supposed to be a forcing function. It was supposed to be a pain point for so many members of Congress that it would force them to enact some other form of deficit reduction. The problem, though, has been that, you know, here we are in the fiscal situation that we're in. You know, you're not faced with very good options. None of the options available are politically very popular. You know, sure, you could cut defense spending to help reduce overall government spending and reduce the deficit. You could cut non-defense spending on things like, you know, the Food and Drug Administration, air traffic controllers, Homeland Security, things like that. But that actually is not that much money. It doesn't add up to a whole lot. Or you could cut spending on some of the large government programs like Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. But, you know, those programs have a large constituency that's also spread across every single congressional district. On the other side of the equation, you could increase revenues. And at the end of the day, that means people have to pay more in taxes. You know, none of these ideas for deficit reduction are particularly popular. So, you know, I think at the end of the day, members of Congress, they are political. They're going to have to sit down and make a political decision of what do they think is in the best interest of their district and in their own political futures. And they're going to have to weigh heavily between, you know, cutting something else or raising someone else's taxes or cutting defense, allowing some, if not all, of these defense cuts to go through as currently prescribed in law.
And what is your prediction on sequestration? Do you think it's more likely the Republicans in the House have agreed to put off the debt ceiling debate? So it looks like they may be focusing on sequestration as their trigger point.
So when the debt ceiling was set to be breached around the same time as sequestration, I thought that actually made sequestration more likely to occur because all the effort would be focused on coming up with a way to lift the debt ceiling. Now that they've suspended the debt ceiling until May 18th, you know, I think that actually makes sequestration a little less likely to happen because they're going to now members of Congress can focus on it. The challenge, though, is still that Republicans are going to want spending cuts to offset anything that puts off sequestration. That means that they'll need about $1 trillion in spending cuts. Democrats look at this, and I think they'd rather do it with revenues. You know, at the end of the day, it may end up, I think it's less likely now, but it may end up that both sides look at sequestration and they say, you know, this is probably better than any compromise deal we could reach with the other guy. So let's just let it go into effect. I think that's the thing that, you know, people in the defense community are concerned about and should continue to watch carefully.
That's Todd Harrison. He's a senior fellow, Defense Budget Studies, the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments in Washington, D.C. The Department of Defense's continuing resolution is funded at 2012 levels, and a lot of people are concerned that defense cuts will be coming if sequestration goes through, and it will have an effect on employment in Puget Sound area. This is Weekday.
After Mandela, the struggle for freedom in post-apartheid South Africa. In a minute, KUOW 94.9 Seattle. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 10:26.
Hello again, I'm Warren Alney. On the next To the Point, in the inaugural speech of his second term, a victorious president laid down a challenge to the GOP. Republicans responded with a promise of new appeals to a changing electorate. Will that mean rethinking core policies or hunkering down and focusing on new political strategies? Next time on To the Point from Public Radio International.
That's just a little over half an hour from now, this morning at 11.
Support for KUOW comes from the Seattle Boat Show, with more than 1,000 boats on display January 25th through February 3rd at CenturyLink Field and South Lake Union, with a shuttle between locations. Tickets online at seattleboatshow.com.
41 degrees in Seattle with showers across the area. Forecast says breezy and rainy all day with a high of 43. A look at the healing power of art a little bit later this hour.
HIV, global capitalism, democracy arrived in South Africa around the same time. The promise of the Mandela era has not yet been met. The nation struggles with an epidemic of poverty, illness, and violence. Will the next generation of leaders reshape the culture and the political realities of the nation? Douglas Foster is a former editor of Mother Jones. He's associate professor at Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism, and he's the author of After Mandela, The Struggle for Freedom in Post-Apartheid South Africa. Thank you for being here.
It's a pleasure to be here.
How come you pay attention to South Africa?
Well, I think anybody who came up in my generation in the 70s and 80s, if you were in demonstrations against the Vietnam War, for the environment, pro-civil rights, there was a sense that freedom in the U.S., freedom around the world, was linked to the anti-apartheid struggle that led to democracy in South Africa. So that's in the backdrop. Then roll forward to 1990, when Nelson Mandela made his triumphal tour around the world when he was released from prison. He came to Oakland Coliseum, where I was living in Oakland then, and he said, "We are about to create a non-racial, non-sexist, non-homophobic, more egalitarian society at the southern tip of Africa. Come and see us." Took me a while to get there. I didn't get there until 2004, 10 years into this experiment. But it had long been an ambition of mine to see what kind of progress had been made along that road.
Did you believe it when he made that statement in the 90s?
I don't think anybody thought that it would happen overnight. I think this is one of the places where media coverage futzed up the terrain in a way. All that language about the Mandela miracle, you know, et cetera, as if miraculous things happen in human history. Certainly it was a remarkable moment that a generation of people who were fighting for liberation came out of prison, came back from exile, came out of their hiding places in South Africa after decades of struggling to overthrow the white minority regime. But I figured that it was going to be a long, hard road, and it certainly has been, partly because of what you mentioned at the top, that it not only democracy arrived, but a moment when South Africa, which had been kind of hived off from the world economy, suddenly was linked back up to a rapidly changing capitalist economy. And the second thing was HIV, obviously, which tipped into epidemic proportions right at the moment when this freedom arrives. It's a second-level trauma, not maybe as large or as longstanding as apartheid, but certainly as devastating in its effects.
Well, and immediately controversial because of the president who denied it, denied the efficacy of the drugs that were being used.
Right. There were two stages, really. There was the period when Nelson Mandela came in as president in 1994, and the old man often says that if he ends up in hell instead of in heaven when he dies, it will be because of the inaction on HIV. Of course, that government coming in 1994 was facing, it's one of those cases where the urgent need to do something about HIV was driven out by the immediate, a fear that there might be a right-wing coup attempt against the new government, a sense that everything was on the line in a bankrupt state to prove that the ANC could run things well, and all of a sudden you have this burgeoning, sexually transmissible, potentially fatal disease. Then Mbeki, Thabo Mbeki, replaces Nelson Mandela as president of the country in 1999, and he did not believe that HIV was the cause of AIDS. He believed that there was a conspiracy by international pharmaceutical companies and the CIA to hobble the South African revolution by forcing the new government to put all of its money into treatment for this one disease.
Isn't that interesting? You know, you're going to talk, just by way of tangent, you're going to talk today at 12:30 at the School of Law, and your topic is health and the struggle for freedom. Is that because in this modern era, health is a struggle that could affect freedom?
Sure. I mean, it's something we know in this country in terms of the fight for more equitable access to health, disparities in even lifespan for African Americans, for example. But there, as a result of 300 years of highly racially segregated society, exacerbated by more than 40 years of a extreme and peculiar form of racial segregation known as apartheid, these disparities are vast. So HIV, as we know in this country, reveals all the fault lines in any society. And in South Africa, you see that in great relief, in great stark relief in terms of the effects on 80% of the population, which is black.
Douglas Foster has written After Mandela, The Struggle for Freedom in Post-Apartheid South Africa. So this is a book of many people that you talk to, many individuals. But I want to start a little bit higher up. You asked, you did an interview with one young man, and we'll get to him in a minute, but a question that you asked every young person you'd interviewed that year: you're living in a country that people died and fought to make free, so how free do you feel? What kind of answers were you getting, and who was giving the different answers?
You know, all over the map. My big goal with this book was to kind of tell an upstairs, downstairs generational story. And so I did hundreds of interviews with hundreds of South Africans at a time between the ages of 15 and 24, because it's a young society. Half the population is 24 and under.
Wow.
40% of the population is 18 and under. So that portion of the population never experienced apartheid directly, certainly has experienced the aftermath directly. And I think the answer depends a lot on where somebody is sitting. If somebody is in a family among the 2 million black people, for example, who have moved into middle-income status under the new dispensation, the answer is considerably more free than my father or my grandfather. If somebody's sitting in a rural area where the rates of HIV are sky high, where very little development has happened, then it's very hard for that person to say anything other than, I still have a little bit of hope.
And they do. They still
absolutely.
Have a little
bit of hope. I mean, what's stunning, if you just looked at the numbers, for example, and you said, here's a society where 80% of the population is black, and 75% of blacks between 15 and 24 are unemployed, you would not expect to find 53% of that population saying, I expect my life and the life of my children to be better than it was for my parents. And I think part of that is even for people who haven't experienced the direct effect of the change, they've seen it happen to others.
And that is true. You see that as well. I mean, it's hard to keep hope alive unless you see something.
Yeah, it's visible. Sure, it's visible. You know, to the extent that the ANC, the African National Congress, as the governing party, has delivered water, electricity, and homes to vast numbers of people, created a social safety net that means very few people starve. That wasn't true under the old regime. People do see these kind of minimal standards set, and they also see, even for people who are quite frustrated and see the ANC promise of holding to its historic, quote, bias towards the poor, unquote, that there remains this rhetoric and tremendous planning effort to try to figure out how to redistribute wealth and opportunity.
I'm curious how the young white people of South Africa view their roles, opportunities, and responsibilities.
Sure.
To their fellow citizens.
It's a big mix. What wasn't surprising to me is finding some young white people who say everything has changed in this country. It's going to the dogs. My future is in London or in Australia or the U.S. And there has been some out-migration, particularly among young English-speaking whites. What was more surprising to me were people like Thomas Marie, who's the son of the leader of the opposition, Helen Zille, who said to me that he thought young white people had been more liberated by what happened in 1994 going forward than in any other sector, because they had been relieved of the tremendous guilt that whites carried for so many decades of being responsible for a white minority regime where the oppression was explicit, and yet haven't had to give up any of their advantages. And his conclusion from that was that there needs to be much more of what he called an FDR New Deal kind of program to create more avenues of social mobility for blacks.
I saw he said that. Do you think that would work? So a kind of massive government spending that we saw in the 30s, or that some people argued we needed to see here?
I think it's exactly actually what's happened in the last couple of years and is happening and beginning to show some results in the National Development Plan, mostly kicked off by some of the spending leading up to the World Cup of 2010, which meant the refurbishing and the building of new stadiums, but also other infrastructure, housing, hotels, roads, and the rest. And that did create these kind of entry-level jobs for people who had been underskilled, getting skills in construction and other things that created this bubbling up.
So this is the World Cup opportunity. Did that opportunity continue today? I mean, is there other places where people can apply those skills?
Yes. In manufacturing and in construction, there are places that some people can go. The problem with the World Cup, as every country that's held one of these extravaganzas has found out, is that the World Soccer Federation pulled up an enormous amount of tax-free money out of the country, and there was that bust that came right after the event. And that was felt very heavily, of course, by people at the bottom.
Doug Foster is author of After Mandela. This is a book about you're looking at the leadership, even in some of the children and grandchildren of the leaders. Does Mandela's grandson show you hope for the future, or sort of a reversion to the powers of the past?
One of the things that makes me cautiously optimistic about where the country is going is the sensibility, the sense of history, and also the sense of obligation and responsibility that the emerging black elite feels and has begun to exercise. So among the six young people who kind of thread the narrative of this book is Indaba Mandela, one of Mandela's grandsons. And I think he represents both the burden of the past, He grew up in Soweto at a very violent period, and there, you know, the generation of these kids may not have experienced the depredations of apartheid, but they certainly experienced the violence that came with the mass rebellion that led to apartheid's fall. So he carries that with him, an understanding and a witness to that kind of violence. He carries with him the legacy of HIV because he himself is an AIDS orphan. Both of his parents, Nelson Mandela's son and Indaba's mother, died of HIV disease, showing that even if you come from the most storied and beloved families in the world, you're not immune from the depredations of drug addiction and HIV infection. So he carries that. What he also carries is a sense that, as he told me, his grandfather grew up as a shoeless cowherd in the rural Transkei. He ran away to the city. He became a lawyer. Then he became a guerrilla leader and committed his entire life to the liberation of his country, came out and managed to oversee a kind of transformation that was different from one that the world had ever seen before, a peaceful transition. So there's a sense of legacy there and a commitment, I think, in a significant proportion. Not everybody. Some people have, you know, lofted into these realms of high earning jobs and left the past behind and willing just to jettison the poor. But I think there's a significant component of what Mbeki's strategists actually called the patriotic bourgeoisie that these people are becoming, which is very clear about the history, taking these new opportunities and using them in a way that pushes a more redistribution of wealth and power.
Do they need to bring Afrikaans-speaking whites in along with them, and do they come? Or is there still a separation?
Yeah, I think what surprises people is that Afrikaans-speaking whites, I believe, from all the interviewing I've done in the last 8 years, feel like they have more of a place in the new South Africa than maybe English-speaking whites do. And I think it's a kind of curious thing because we associate apartheid, partly because the word is in Afrikaans, it means apartness. We think of them as the more racist group responsible for apartheid. But when apartheid fell, Afrikaans-speaking whites had no place else to go. They had a commitment to making the new dispensation work out. English-speaking whites, this is a crude generalization that will piss off a lot of the people who are listening, but they had dual passports to London, to Australia, elsewhere. And when things got tough, instead of reengaging or insisting on a kind of accommodation with language, as in the case of Afrikaans, more of them tended to leave.
So you talk about Mandela's grandson as being somebody who's a headman in the village. And you write about this, what did you call it? Upcountry power versus the way identity is mutable in cities. How is that generation? Are they trying to be both? Are they trying to be people of the village and people of the city, or are people having to cut ties?
It's beginning to change. So you're talking about Mandla Mandela, another Mandela grandson who became the chief of the birthplace of Nelson Mandela in a kind of strange, it seemed like a strange reversal at the time. He'd grown up in Soweto. He'd been educated at Rhodes, going back to a very poor rural area and becoming the chief. I think a lot of the young people, you know, if you ask an older South African, who are you, which is the way I always began interviews, and you ask the president, Jacob Zuma, who are you, he'll say, I am Jacob Zuma. I come from Nkandla. There's always an association back to the home village, even if the person hasn't been there for decades. If you ask young people, even who have recently come from rural areas, who are you? They might say, as one of the Mandela grandsons said to me, I'm Vusi Mandela, and I come from a particular neighborhood in Johannesburg. So I think those ties to the rural areas have begun to break down. There's a massive migration to the cities. And one of the things to be worked out in the next couple of years in South Africa's politics is what are the roles of those traditional leaders? Should they continue to exercise the kind of control they had under apartheid and have had in the early years of democracy as well?
You know, when we read about South Africa, we hear about danger.
Yeah.
It's that there's crime, street crime, and you have people who are part of that street crime in this story, or the young white kid who's just accepts being mugged as part of his daily ritual. Is it dangerous to be in South African cities?
It's certainly dangerous to be in some neighborhoods. You know, every time I go to South Africa, I face this expectation by the people I meet that I'm going to see it as a place just of dysfunction, right? Crime, HIV, and the rest. And, you know, the editor of the Sunday Times told me that the only place he had ever been mugged in his life was in Chicago, near where I live. So there's a bit of a pushback. But certainly, the crime rate, the rates of violent crime are among the highest of anywhere in the world, including in combat zones. Including in places where there are active civil wars. So we see this as a continuation of patterns of high levels of violence under apartheid. But there's something else going on that I think people haven't really pinned down. And I try to tell that part of the story through the vantage point, through the eyes of a particular young man who comes into the city as a runaway and becomes first a beggar, then a thief, then an armed thief, and worse, as a way to try to get at what is underneath these continuing rates of high rates of violent crime in the society.
But you could have told his story in the south side of Chicago in some ways.
Maybe, but and that's an important story that's being told, including on your air this morning. But the level of it is so much higher, what's fueling it is so much higher. You know, I said 75% of black young people between 15 and 24 unemployed. That's one obvious fuel. It doesn't explain the particular deep level of violence associated with robbery, carjackings, and home invasions, however.
All right. I want to end just with a question for you. You talk about Johnny Clegg throughout this book, and I wanted to leave with some Johnny Clegg music. So Johnny Clegg, South African musician who took a stand against apartheid as a white South African and played in a mixed group long before the end of apartheid. Does he have a legacy for young people? Does he have an importance for young people, or is he of the past?
No, it's huge. I think this history, the cultural history, is really important. And for people like Johnny Clegg and his performing partner, back in the 70s, to have done what they did was astonishing. Just to have a white person and a black person from KwaZulu-Natal speak to each other both in English and isiZulu, to respect each other's background and language, to create songs together in both languages, to perform around the country when they were forbidden to do so and were often had their shows shut down, and then to continue to perform into the new dispensation. There's a huge following, not only among his generation, but among the next generation, who understand the courage that it took for people politically, culturally, socially to say, apartheid is bunk.
The power of art. After Mandela, the struggle for freedom in post-apartheid South Africa. Douglas Foster. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
He'll be talking on the UW Campus School of Law in Gates Hall about health and the struggle for freedom at 12:30 today. Here's a little Johnny Clegg.
Speaking of the power of art, some thoughts on how art can help us through difficult times in a minute. KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Christine Palmer and Associates, presenting antiques and collectibles shows in the Northwest for more than 30 years. Next show, February 2nd and 3rd at the Puyallup Fairgrounds Showplex, with 400 vendors and thousands of items from the 1880s to the 1970s.
KUOW and City of Auburn present L.A. Theater Works performing Pride and Prejudice at the Auburn Performing Arts Center on Saturday, February 9th at 7:30 p.m. For more information, visit our events page at KUOW.org. 41 degrees and rainy in Seattle. Expect the rain to stick around, at least as showers, through most of the week, with daytime temps right around 50 degrees. We might see a little sun on Friday and Saturday. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 10:50. Violence continues in Cairo a day after President Mohamed Morsi declared a state of emergency. We are following developments there, and we'll get an update from NPR News in about 10 minutes.
Now we're going to talk about how art can heal individuals as well as whole nations. How do you work through difficult moments in your life? Suzanne Edison does it through poetry. She is a psychotherapist, a poet, and the mother of a child with juvenile myositis. What is that?
Juvenile myositis is a rare autoimmune disease in which your body, the vascular system, basically attacks the rest of your body, your muscles, your skin, your organs. Could be any part of your body, really. There's a wide range of symptoms.
How old is she?
She's now 12, and actually she's doing really well. It's an autoimmune disease for which there's no cure. It's very rare, 2 to 3 million, and 2 to 3 in a million have it. There's potential for remission, and we are very fortunate that she is in remission. So she's been off medicine for over a year.
So I listened to a couple of poems. I read a few others, but I listened to a couple of poems. And I was thinking to myself, how does she feel about being in a poem, these very personal and painful things being revealed and discussed? How is she?
She pretty much ignores it most of the time. Yeah.
But she knows you do it.
She knows I do it, but she doesn't like to be around or be identified that it's her.
For you personally, you turned to poetry, or was it because of the work you do that poems emerged from this?
I was a poet before she was ill, and really as soon as she was diagnosed, I've sort of stopped writing, and it took me several months to kind of come back to it, and then it was like taking the proverbial finger out of the dike, and, you know, everything just started flowing, and I did it to just keep myself going and reduce stress, and I figured I had to write about what I was going through at the same time that I was trying to, you know, help my child get well.
You know, so you have other jobs, right? Family support director for the Cure JM Foundation. You've led workshops, given presentations on chronic illness, on
right.
families and coping with chronic illness. Did you know that the poetry would give you the vehicle by which you could talk to other people?
Not really, no. When I first started writing about my own journey, it was just to, like I said, you know, keep myself going and keep myself alive. And then it began to snowball, and I realized that people were interested in what I had to say. And I wrote a few grants to try to get some money to keep focused on the writing itself. And I started some support groups at Children's Hospital for parents who had kids with juvenile myositis. And there, in that process, which was mostly a talking support kind of system, oftentimes what happens, I think, in support groups is that you talk a lot about your pain and your upset, but you don't get to move beyond it. And I knew for myself that writing was a way to help me move through it, as well as find some sparks of life that were still enjoyable and creative.
How does it help you move through it? It goes onto the paper and it becomes cathartic? I mean, you still remain with the pain.
Catharsis is something that I think we were trained, I was trained, you know, back in the 70s and 80s to think that was the end process for dealing with emotional upset. But now, and particularly with a lot of new brain research and with traumatic stress, and I think that having a child with chronic illness leads to a form of traumatic stress, that the writing is a way of not only experiencing your emotions, but also helping you to think through them and beyond them, so that you can get sort of them down on paper. But then you have the opportunity, if you have some good structures, I think, and maybe help to think them through. How do you connect how do you use your feelings to move forward? You know, when you have a child who's ill, you have to learn how to advocate. You have to learn about the illness. You have to figure out how to take care of them, deal with medicines. And for many parents, I think that's really hard, and you can get stuck in those bad, bad feelings.
What do you mean by good structures? What are you talking about?
Well, I've started to both read and create writing structures for other people. So exercises, writing exercises that help you not only experience your feelings, but help you get a little bit of distance so that you're able to engage your prefrontal cortex in brain language, move away from just the pain in which, you know, all your emotional life sort of centered in your amygdala. Figure out through the physical writing and the capacity to think about the writing helps you to the writing becomes a form or a vessel to hold those feelings and to help you think.
Was there a moment for you when you, because you are a practiced writer before, was there a moment for you when you said, ah, this is, I see what I'm doing here with myself? Or was it many moments?
Many moments. And it took me a while to realize that, I really was doing my catharsis in the beginning. And I remember somebody saying to me, you know, poetry is more than just undigested feelings on the page. And so part of the process and the training of being a poet and a writer is revision. And I love that word because you have to not only revise the words, but you get to see it anew. And so for many of the poems, it took a long time to just let them sit on the page, come back to them over and over again.
Suzanne Edison is a psychotherapist, a poet, mother of a child with juvenile myositis. She's the family support director for the Cure the JM Foundation. She's been awarded grants from the City of Seattle and For Culture to write and publish a chapbook of poems based on her journey and her child's journey. Do you have a poem?
I do. This new set of poems was also another grant in which I decided I wanted to interview and have conversations with many different parents who had kids with a variety of different illnesses. And so this poem called Only Serious Applicants Need Apply is more of a composite of many voices. Only serious applicants need apply. In the club you never wanted to join is a job you didn't apply for. Your qualifications dubious. Requirements include multiple personality transformations. Nurse, masseuse, psychotherapist, physical and occupational therapist, pharmacist, nutritionist, medical researcher, vice president in charge of all paperwork, insurance nag, professional wish you knew it all and hate that you don't. Benefits include seeing the neighbor coming home late, coyotes prowling your urban streets, the moon in all phases, hearing the house creak shift, the newspaper slam against your unlocked door, alley cats mating, a sound not unlike your child crying, which makes the hair on your arm rise. And for the fourth or fifth time, you must check her room, her breathing. Inhale the delicate sleep smell of her. Because when you signed up for motherhood, fatherhood, you didn't think it included a future with a child who may not have one. When children are sick, I think the whole family is affected, and it's parents go through many different stages of grief and loss, similar to, I think, Kubler-Ross's stages of dying, and you're not prepared. Just not prepared.
We're upended. Do you feel that talking to those folks have given them the tools? I mean, you must, because you've continued, but talking to them, did they feel like they were empowered toward the end?
I don't think that just having the conversations were empowering, but I feel that coming back with the writing helps to give them a voice. I feel that, you know, several parents came up to me afterwards and said, you got it. You've captured it. I couldn't have said it any better. Thank you.
Suzanne Edison is blogging and talking about these ideas at C. Edison. That's very nice. But we'll have a link and you'll see some of her work and maybe put a couple of the poems you recorded up on our Facebook page so people can find you that way too.
That'd be great.
I appreciate you talking to us.
Thank you.
It's a whirlwind on a day like today, isn't it? We just ran a horse race, and now we've come in and we've won. What Cannot Be Swallowed is her latest chapbook. Susanna Edison is a psychotherapist, a poet, and a mother.
Thank you.
Thank you. This is Weekday.
Hours, right?
You can come and do it again.
By the way, if you like poetry and thinking about poetry and literature, you can get more of both this afternoon during the 2 o'clock hour here on KUOW. The latest on the deadly nightclub fire in Brazil in the news in a minute. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from STG, presenting Hubbard Street Dance Chicago, performing two works by Israeli choreographers, February 9th at the Paramount Theater. More information at stgpresents.org.
-41 degrees and rainy in Seattle. Looks like it's going to be breezy and rainy all day with a high. Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.